Thank you for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. My name is Mark Ward, and today I'm talking about the role of the CISO and how it has been changed by the pandemic over the last couple of years. Talking with me today are Monica Verma, who's currently CISO at the Norwegian Director of Health and a regular presenter on her own podcast called Monica Talks Cyber. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for this podcast as well. Also here is Paul Watts, a distinguished analyst at the ISF, who was a CISO for 16 years before joining. Hello, everybody. So just to get things going, Monica, I saw that you posted a note to LinkedIn about how everyone's suffering with the Log4j bug this Christmas, and last year we had SolarWinds. And I just wonder, between those two, between that, you know, that intervening time, has the pandemic changed how your organization expects you and, I guess, other CISOs to respond? Has it done good things, bad things to the role? Are you having different kinds of conversations at the moment?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I said in the post was that cybersecurity is like a gift that keeps on giving. And it kind of is, because you have both the amazing positive things that have happened because of that, but then obviously you have the challenges and the struggle of how much the supply chain attacks, the ransomware attacks, and the cloud abuse attacks, at least, especially these three, have skyrocketed, right? Amidst when there has been a need for remote work, there has been a need for digitalization at the same time. So obviously the expectations have increased, the challenges have increased, the time frame to get things done has reduced. That has put a lot of pressure. It has also brought us a bit more better mandate as CISOs, and we have to do things differently. We cannot do the things the same way as has been done for the last 20 years. And there are various reasons for that. One is that the whole information security field has also evolved quite drastically in the last 20 years. We started with servers and networks, and that was mostly what it was. And today we have so many subdomains within information security, and you kind of have to look at them holistically and how they integrate with each other. The other aspect is obviously the supply chains have gotten more complex, bigger, and global. I mean, there's so many examples of CloudHopper. There are examples of what happened with Cognizant. There's an example of SolarWinds. There's an example of Equifax. Another example of Log4j. Both supply chains in general, cloud supply chains, software supply chains. I mean, the interesting part is that we as CISOs and the organizations in general, the organization is still owning the risk. You have to own your supply chain. The risk across your supply chain are still your own accountability. And that makes it an even more difficult task. So yes, absolutely. It has done some wonderful things, but also has put very critical demand for thinking things differently. Very important.
Paul, would you agree with that? Because I guess I think you have quite a technical background. So I just wonder if, you know, the latter days of your time as a CISO, you know, I guess there was a very different split in terms of the skills that you had to call on to do the job.
Yeah, I think organizations are waking up to the fact that the definition of supply chain has changed. So we used to have the conversations about supply chain risk, and it was, you know, Joe and Sons, this, you know, the stapler manufacturer who sends me, you know, products five or six times a year. Now that's kind of transcending into providers of services that are digital in nature. I think the ease in which that service can be sprawled across organizations also means that control has started to become increasingly difficult to wrestle back. The other thing as well is the concept of fourth party risk. So whilst you're looking at your direct supply chain, there are also sub-suppliers and sub-processes sitting behind that. And that starts to increase the complexity that you seem to have. And as Monica said, you know, we've had some really live wire examples of where the supply chain weaknesses have really come to roost. SolarWinds is a cracking example of that. Cognizant had some issues in 2020, where business-to-business interoperability was brought into pretty sharp focus in that. So Cognizant are being affected. We use them. What's our impact? And those questions started to become more and more pervasive. So I think the tide is turning, and the sheer gravity of supply chains in organizations is just really starting to surface now. And I think this is going to be a hot topic in 2022 as well. I don't know if you agree with that, Monica.
Absolutely. I think supply chains are here to stay, and supply chain attacks.
Yeah, but I just wonder, yeah, I think, because certainly the, you know, as a former journalist and some of the reflecting on the things I used to write about, and a lot of those were in the early days were about breaches, in particular vulnerabilities, and, you know, well, the new thing, the bad guy found, or the bad guys found and exploited and organized a breach. But in the later days of my career, it was much more about those business impacts and just what it did to the organization. It wasn't just about the data went missing. It was about, well, what effect did that have? And I just wonder, was that reflected in the role of the CISO as well? Just you get different questions and people know more about what you do and you're just more involved with the business. Is that a bigger change? I mean, I guess, Monica, working for a health organization, you must have had a hell of a year, hell of a couple of years, because it was, you're right in the middle of all aspects of dealing with the pandemic, on, you know, treating people and running that organization as well.
Absolutely. We have had to have heightened crisis management team in place for the health crisis that's going on and has been for the last 2 years. On top of that, you have to obviously ensure that you have better resilience for your systems, for your services. You getting a cyber attack, getting ransomware or a cyber attack or loss of services amidst the healthcare crisis is just massive consequences, right? That would not be something that would be really great. We are talking about societal consequences. And at the same time, if you imagine services that are healthcare services needed for providing these health services, not necessarily from our organization, but generally in health sector, when they go down and or they're ransomware or cyber attack by different various attack vectors, then the consequences can be humongous, right? And these are not something that we really look forward to as CISOs. Obviously, some of the things that have happened is, yes, we focus more on business consequences. We're able to better talk to the board and to the management and help them understand the importance of investing in cybersecurity as a result of the massive consequences, but not something that's necessarily that we want. So it's kind of like, yeah, there's both sides to it.
Yeah, would you agree, Paul? I mean, is it sort of, it's all very well having a crisis, but I suppose don't waste it as a CISO. You know, if you see what, you know, slightly... you have to plan and plot a bit and see what you can come out of it at the other end, your organization better prepared, I guess, and also yourself get that recognition because you've got the plans in place. You can say, see, we executed, we sorted this out.
Yeah, it's a relentless struggle now. You know, the more and more organizations digitally transform, the more and more the realization that, you know, a blip in technology, which, you know, the IT teams would be able to deal with, have significant consequences to business. And I think sometimes whilst you can kind of, you know, enjoy the opportunity, the window of opportunity to talk to the board, actually, it's more about understanding what those business consequences are. And I think that does, to some extent, expose some of the fractures in the relationships between security teams and the businesses if they're not very, very well established. So it's all well and good our peer group worrying about a zero-day vulnerability and having to run around and patch everything and just want to drop servers at a heartbeat. But if we're not understanding and appreciating the realities of the implications of either an exploitation in motion or the need to get in front of it before it occurs, then we're almost missing a trick. And it's becoming more and more critical for CISOs to think like the business and the business to understand the implications of digital transformation. That requires changes on both sides, I think. And interestingly, Monica, you may have a view of this as well. It's starting to become quite popular to have the idea of a business information security officer. So somebody who is, you know, very much in the security space, but their predominant interest is the business ramifications of that. And that's a really, really good then marriage back to traditional core governance, risk, compliance, security teams. It just allows you to get a really, really fine balance of understanding the impacts of technological risk, the impacts of business and how the two kind of come together. But what I would say is, and, you know, my heart goes out to, you know, my colleagues dealing with Log4j at the moment. It's not a nice opportunity to have anymore because it's just so relentless. As quickly as we clean up one 0 day, another one comes along. And this is the hold my drink of all vulnerabilities to deal with because it's just everywhere.
Mm. Absolutely. I mean, what's interesting is that I fully agree that the business information security officer roles are getting more and more famous now and more organizations are incorporating a role. At the same time, I believe every chief information security officer as well needs to understand, we kind of need that mindset that security is not the end goal. Every organization has a mission, a vision, what is the purpose behind what they're doing. And it's so different. I mean, if you look at finance sector, because I've been working in the finance sector before I came to health sector for 15 years. And when you look at finance sector, the most important aspect of security is integrity. You don't want changes in the trading systems or in the money and the finance systems where they're not done in a good right way. And there's the loss of integrity is one of the biggest criteria here when you're looking into security. But when you look into health, it's kind of different because at one end, you want confidentiality of the health information, obviously, but at the same time, you have to really understand availability. Not having services at the cost of confidentiality that can lead to life and death. Those are the kind of consequences one needs to think of before one says, okay, are these controls really what we need? Because a bit too much in the either direction can then actually go against the purpose and the mission of the organization. And that's where these nuances are really important. And I think I feel like really a lot, especially with the pandemic and the crisis going on. I mean, the good example of that is what we saw in Dusseldorf University Hospital, when the hospital was ransomware and services were down. And one of the patients was driven to another hospital and could not get treatment at the hospital because of the ransomware attack. And then at the end, the patient died and there was actually investigations by the police to check what happened. They found out, okay, the condition of the patient was too bad nonetheless. So had she gotten the treatment there, she would have still probably died. But I mean, these are not far-fetched scenarios anymore when a crisis, cyber crisis becomes a systemic risk and the consequences are then societal and then leading to bigger business consequences across organizations, right? And that's really important understanding. And Log4j, we are just touching the surface of vulnerability here. We have no idea about the impact and the consequences to follow. That is going to unwrap and unveil itself in the next weeks and months to come. So I think this gift specifically will continue to keep on giving in the next year.
Yeah, can you send that one back? Give it to someone else, maybe.
It really does shine a light on the you know, obviously the work that Apache does is fantastic, and it's testament to how fantastic the work is and just how prolific this library is. But a lot of organizations will take a step back and they'll say, right, Log4j is vulnerable, we need to patch it, that's great, right, where is it? And then the number of conversations I've had over the past 4 days where people have said, it's unbelievable just how far this rabbit hole goes. And it really does hammer home something that I think is quite important as well, is understanding the dependencies between business and technology. We've talked about that, and obviously the incident in Dusseldorf was probably one of the first deaths associated with ransomware threats. So that really hammered it home, despite how it played out. But I think just as fundamental as that is the dependencies within technology themselves. You know, if you don't understand how those relationships are, you know, you can say, right, I'm going to take this system down and patch it. But if you don't know what the consequences of taking that system down are, A, technically, and B, operationally, it's dangerous to take the system down in the first place. So actually, you're kind of coming back to the world of configuration management. Do we understand the relationships between our systems, the relationships between our systems and our business outcomes, and then the relationship between the business outcomes and the potential business impacts if we can't do that? And that's a very, very fragile ecosystem. And, you know, the notion of it being the gift that keeps on giving, you know, we're looking at embedded devices, we're looking at third-party services, we've now got to worry about SaaS providers who have got our data, who may be vulnerable as well. You know, are they moving at the speed that I need them to move at? And it just becomes bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, one of the interesting tweets I saw these past days was that, well, if AWS goes down, then I don't have to worry about Log4j.
That's very true.
No, but you've got to worry about everything else.
Different kind of problem.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, add to that the complexity of IT and convergence with OT. Complex it gets, how much more legacy systems we have, and how deep the rabbit hole goes. And that's actually correct. I mean, one of the things that I've now seen the past days is finding out which systems are affected, not just within your four walls, but then at your service providers, and then at their service providers, and at their service providers. I mean, it's like asset inventory. We can't find what we don't see.
Exactly. But just to ask a slightly controversial question, I suppose, is this not where CISOs want it to be? Because I've talked to quite a few CISOs who have that technical background and do feel like they want to leave that behind and step up and be taken seriously by their organization. But, you know, suddenly, like you say, Paul, they could be in the crosshairs every minute of every day because they are worrying about the business and they can trace their dependencies. And
I've always said to colleagues who, I mean, Monica, you've probably been there as well, where you go to the usual echo chambers, all the CISOs together, and we go, oh, I can't get engagement with the board, they don't want to talk to me. And I've always said, be careful what you wish for, because sooner or later, that's going to be an utter slam dunk. And I think what's happening now is CXOs and boards are feeling a certain vulnerability. You know, they've ridden the coattails of this idea of digital transformation, and I don't necessarily think that everybody understands exactly what is meant by that. They're seeing their competitors, they're seeing their service providers being hit with ransomware, they're seeing concerns in the mainstream medias about vulnerabilities in softwares, vulnerabilities in the supply chain, and they feel vulnerable. So they're reaching out and going, Where's that person who does security? Right, get them in here. Suddenly, you are somebody who can kind of support. But then the question's kind of turned on you to say, well, why haven't you got control of all of this? Why aren't you running faster? Why is this suddenly now a problem? And you think, well, step number one was actually us having a conversation. But now I feel like I'm the back foot because you're complaining that I haven't moved quick enough. But I can't move quick enough without the budget. I can't get the budget without understanding the risk. I can't understand the risk if I don't know what my mission critical assets business processes are. And it's just this horrible perfect circle. So whilst it's nice that we've got engagement with our boards and with our leaders, it's the start of a relationship that needs to be built up over time. You know, there is value return to be had on both sides, and both sides will need to make concessions and conciliations before that can become a really constructive relationship. I don't want to be in the situation when I'm dragged into the board every time a Log4j style incident occurs and feel like I'm having to, you know, fight a battle not only with the adversary, but with my board as well. It needs to be a shared accountability and a shared responsibility that CISO and CEO work together to solve.
Here's my take on this. I think what has happened, I don't think that we CISOs wanted to be in exactly this place. I think what we wanted was progress over time, and obviously a bit like fast progress on an ecosystem that was provided to us in terms of support, budget, investments, decision-making, responsibility. But what happened is that the acceleration due to pandemic was so fast that suddenly the accountability is shifted towards you and then you're put right in the spotlight for, hey, what's happening? But the problem with that is that accountability is still with the board. You cannot put the accountability on CISOs. It's just not the right place, because the CISOs do not have, they're not in the place signing off these things to ensure, they're not in the right position to have the accountability for this. So what has happened is that the acceleration has happened in terms of exposure to what has gone wrong and how can you fix it right away. But all the support system that has been needed for this is not moved fast enough yet along with it. So what we really needed or wanted was an ecosystem. And sure, this is obviously the demand of the time. So we have to adjust and adapt to it. And that's what these CISOs are doing. And I believe that I'm absolutely incredibly proud of every damn CISO in this world today, because this is extreme circumstances where accountability is kind of like trying to be shifted, but you cannot. Accountability is still with the board and it has to stay with the board. So given the fact that, yes, maybe some CISOs have a bit better budget and a bit better mandate, but this is not compared to the amount of responsibilities and exposure that they have been put to. This is not comparable. So that's where the big gap still lies. And we see that a lot of organizations are still asking the question, how many types of CISOs? I wrote a blog and I was like, oh my God, can we just stop? I mean, every time I Google types of CISOs, there is a whole damn Google page that says, 6 and 7 and 10 types and 2 types and 5 types. And I'm like, no, there is one type of CISO. You cannot have a CISO doing technical hands-on stuff. I mean, we are not even aligned with what a CISO role should actually be. And some CISOs are, I mean, it's a bridge. Yes, absolutely. A CISO should have an understanding of technology works, how it can be used and abused. But you cannot be thinking about the business. You cannot be having the bird's eye view if you're sitting down in the trenches every single day and doing things hands-on all the time. So there kind of has to be that balance. So the conversations that need to be done, I mean, we don't even agree on what kind of one CISO we need to be. And I understand that a CISO really needs to understand how the technology can be used and abused. That's absolutely correct. But you can't be working on business impact and understanding and supporting the business and the vision and having the bird's eye view if you're in the trenches all the time. So this gap and these discussions still need to happen. So that's why I say I applaud the CISOs. I think a lot of hard situations have come, hard decisions have to be made. A lot of CISOs get fired for no reason, where they don't have really the accountability for it. Turnover is quite a lot in cybersecurity, and we also hear quite a lot that turnover for CISO is quite a lot as well. It's what, 1 year to 18 months? That's absolutely nothing. I mean, that's the time when I would assume that we're just getting settled in trying to build a security program. We are in the beginning of it, but there's a reason behind it. And I think we really need to also talk about these aspects of work-life balance and health and mental health across these different aspects that have come now specifically for CISOs and security leaders across the world.
I completely agree with that. It's been a relentless slog over the last couple of years. Certainly with the pandemic, just to see how agile things, you know, CISOs have needed to be. But actually, that's an interesting point as well. So, you know, a couple of my security leadership roles, I was the first CISO through the door. You know, comparing notes with other CISOs who were the first through the door is, what is the expectation on a CISO? It's exactly that point. And if you are one in a line of CISOs, then there's a degree of understanding, and you can build on that and that's fine. And I think your point's well made, Monica, in terms of, you know, in 18 months you barely got in, surveyed the lay of the land, reset your short-term strategy and started to deliver on it before you're on your next gig. So that's not healthy for organizations either. But it's, you know, if I was to give anybody some advice in terms of security leadership, if you're the first CISO in an organization, you need to know exactly what it is they think you're doing, and you need to be clear with them what it is you think you're doing, because I guarantee you there will be some disparity, because there is no hard and fast dictionary definition of what a chief information security officer is supposed to do. So your first objective is to make damn sure that you are on the same page. I think the other thing is, if there was any lessons to be learned here for security leaders and actually security practitioners in general, it's, we've got to get more agile at what we do. You know, this isn't an approach that used to work 10 years ago, when we say, right, we're going to build an information security management system. Right, what are our crown jewels? What are our critical assets? What's our policy? You know, what are our controls? Right, now let's do the risk framework. And we've got to be more agile. And, you know, we have to solve problems in real time, working with our business, and get that balance of risk and reward right. So I think there's also a degree of change needed in our world. And Monica, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, is that we've got to come a little bit more agile and a bit more in step with our business as well, and not expect them to follow what is now becoming quite an old orchestrated way of doing information security in organizations.
Absolutely, 100% agree. And I have actually 2 points to share that, because to one point about what a CISO role really is, what are the expectations? I actually wrote a blog, I think it was in the beginning of the pandemic, so not this year, but last year, 2020. I came up with a blog talking about from hacker to CISO. So my whole journey in this industry started as a hacker. And I realized at some point that to get, as I mentioned before, to get the bird's eye view, I kind of need to stop doing the hacking hands-on all the time to actually really get it. But what does it actually entail? And I have really, that one blog is like a one-stop shop for people to ask the questions and understand, what does a CISO role entail? Is it something that you would want to do? Is it something that you understand? And it gives you it highlights into what a day-to-day life of a CISO can look like and how to balance it. I'm not saying that is exactly how every CISO role will be, but it's a very, I have used it as a template in many of my CISO roles and also security leader roles and VCISO roles and so on. And it has really helped me. And one of the things, one of the principles I say there in that is simplify, focus, and execute. You kind of have to like understand, you can't, you're not going to be able to get 100% security, but you can't even do 100% secure everywhere all the time at the same level. The maturity depends on the need of the services and what you're trying to protect. So simplifying the whole work, because it's a complicated field, you need to talk in a way to your, tailored to your audience, whether you're talking to the business, whether you're talking to engineers, whether you're talking to audit team or compliance or privacy officer, having that simplification, then focusing on whether it's threat-based, risk-based, maturity-based, there are different ways of doing it, but for you to understand what does your organization really need, and then executing. I mean, an ISMS is as good as its implementation. I mean, if it's just documentation, then it doesn't really exist, right? So simplify, focus, execute. These are the principles I've really followed, and I think they really help. And the whole blog was about the different skill sets and understandings of what does it entail. So I would really, if anybody's interested, just go and have a look there. But the other point of changing how we have worked before, absolutely. We have to move from just purely preventive-based security to both adaptive and predictive security. And what do I mean by that? I mean, a lot of the focus is obviously in embedding security within a development lifecycle, embedding security within different processes and procurement, and that is fantastic. We have to do that. Nobody's saying you don't have to do that. But since we know the supply chains are more complex, since we know there are a lot of blind spots generally, since we know that we are never gonna cover 100%, we don't even know 100% assets where they are, and we don't know all of these things. So then we know that the breach will happen, right? We already have said that many years now, that it's not a matter of if or question of if, but when. So the point is that when that crisis happens, how early can you detect? How much adaptability do you have along the way when a crisis is actually happening or where you amidst the cyber attack? Can you actually turn up your policies and do segmentation live during a certain system that certain core services are just segregated from the network while you realize that an attack is under process? And there are these kind of things. And then also understanding the predictive part of it. And I believe that in the near future, and it's not that far away, we'll be using ML. I mean, we already are. There are a lot of POCs already there, out there, really using ML and AI to predict these threats that are happening way in advance, right? So to help you understand this, I actually have designed a model, which is called Cybersecurity Adoption Lifecycle Model. It's on also my website, Monica Talk Cyber. It shows the trenches through which a cybersecurity lifecycle goes. And majority of the organization in the world in the market today is in the preventive and the regulatory cybersecurity space. Very few are in the adaptive and the predictive one, but that's where we need to start focusing on, and we need to start thinking resilience. We need to start thinking resilience in terms of workforce, in terms of processes, and in terms of technology that provides adaptability in amidst the ongoing crisis.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, because certainly talking to a few CISOs for some research last year, there was few and far between with those ones who had stepped away from those technical skills and were trying to build up those other ones. And they were definitely all on a similar kind of journey. And I think that's where they wanted to get. And they did want to get taken seriously. And as you say, Paul, they got what they wished for. And occasionally that was a really, that was a gift they didn't want to take. But I just conscious of time. And it's final question I wanted to ask about is that, I guess one of the themes emerging from this conversation is that CISOs are under a lot of pressure. They have a lot of skills to develop. They've got, what they do matters to the business because the attacks can knock the business out. So I just wondered how you two handle burnout, those kinds of things. Just, do you worry about that with your teams? Is that another skill that you've got to try and learn, just how to handle your own health, your mental health, just the way you don't get sucked in by the job all the time, and as well how you look after your teams as well?
Well, look. Security teams never sleep. I mean, the weekend is a perfect testament to that. I've gone non-operational and have for the last few months, but it doesn't stop you caring about what's going on in your industry. And I spent the weekend talking to peers across the industry, trying to offer a bit of help, and also just trying to offer a bit of empathy. It is a horrible, horrible situation to be in when you're in a race against time to protect your organization. And you I remember the first time I got caught in a major incident, and it was almost like an out-of-body experience where everybody said, what do we do next, Paul? And I realised, actually, everybody was looking at me for the answer. And you suddenly think, I'm carrying the weight of the organisation on my shoulders. That is an awfully significant burden. And the pressure is becoming more and more and more. And CISOs are really, really struggling. It's not just CISOs. It is a community that needs to look after itself. You know, we call them the unsung heroes, from your SOC analysts to your threat hunters to your security leaders to your risk managers. It's quite a thankless job. When everything's going okay, nobody wants to talk to you. And when everything's going badly, everybody wants to yell at you. There's nothing kind of in the middle. That is hard and tough mentally and physically on people. And if you've been in the middle of a major incident, you know exactly what it does to you mentally and physically. I think we need to do more. I've talked about this a number of times. A number of my peers have talked about this a lot. It's becoming harder and harder and harder to balance both. It's becoming increasingly difficult to balance work versus life. You're never off the clock. You're always looking at your Twitter feed for the next thing to happen to you. And there's got to, you've got to get this balance right. You know, we talk about it in the Extinction Level Attacks report that the ISS, you know, worked on. You've got to have somebody looking after the incident team, looking after the business. And if you haven't got that, something is going to go bang and you're going to have no way back. It is a significant issue. It's not getting any easier, and it really, really does require some focus. And that starts with an acknowledgement in the business that this is a tough gig.
Absolutely. To add to that, I feel, to answer your question, Mark, I think there are a lot of challenges within our industry, starting from entry-level jobs and entry-level positions and fantastic resources there, all the way up to CISOs. I mean, it's this struggle of not being appreciated enough, not being, like, being kind of like having a thankless job. It's not just for CISOs. I think it's for a lot of different resources within our industry and within our community. A lot of the challenges we have had in the past with security being seen as a roadblock has not completely diminished entirely. Yes, this pandemic has definitely brought us a bit more open understanding towards, well, security is not just a roadblock, right? It's kind of enabling you to do the things in the right way. It's kind of helping you with the digital transformations. But I mean, there's still a lot of organizations that don't understand that. I was on a panel and we did like a poll of who still thinks that cybersecurity is a roadblock versus an opportunity. And they were significant. I think around 40% of people that still thought that it was a roadblock. And I was like, wow, okay. It's at least not more than 50%, but that's a significant percentage, right? And the challenges are different roles. And I think because of the issue with that, we need a lot of cybersecurity people. Our industry is doing, well, not our industry, but our kind of like the hiring managers. There's a lot of gatekeeping within the community still, which is quite sad. The talent grab I keep on talking about, it's not really, the shortage is not in the fact of finding people. The shortage is in the fact of that our minds and the job postings we put and the kind of requirements we set, we are not investing in people. We're not investing in people enough in our community, in our industry, whether it's a junior position, whether it's a senior position, whether it's a CISO. So kind of having that right investment, understanding what their really job entails, and us as security leaders as well, understanding what the team really needs. And for me, I feel like just to give someone, I've recently talked to some colleagues and I've just told them, you know what? If something is in your mind, just come to me and talk. I mean, the doors are always open. Something as simple as that is so powerful. It's so important. And I think a lot of the things just happen when you as leaders can just listen. Sometimes you don't even have to provide a solution. Sometimes the solution is just listening. So having that empathy and compassion for both people within our industry, but also the ones that are wanting to break into the industry, because those are our future soldiers. Those are our future security leaders. And not doing that investment will really hurt us in the long term. So we kind of have to think about that. As far as our own burnout is concerned, yes, I mean, as Paul said, it's a 24/7 job. Even if you're at home, you can't really like not think about it, and you don't know when the next tweet is going to come and things start shattering again and you're called back, right? And for us, it has been also very specific because we're not just dealing with heightened need for cybersecurity, but also the amidst the pandemic and the health crisis that's going on. So what I would recommend, what I do at least try to do to deal with this is, I don't know, do whatever gives you that kind of detachment for even for a couple of hours. I regularly train, I regularly sleep. I know people say that you should not sleep, but I sleep. And I think that's like, maybe I'm saying something which is like very contradictory to our industry, but I don't let things affect my sleep. I think that's very, very important. I don't know, try to get that, try to focus on yourself. It's hard, it's easier said than done, but I think you are the only one. Someone told me this recently, that you have to be your best friend. And I think that is a powerful statement.
I think that's a key point. And actually, as CISOs, we have to lead by example. I always come back to the idea, you hear airline safety briefings. They say, always put your mask on before helping somebody else.
Mm.
Now, that is a metaphor for how security leaders should be working as well. You know, we've got to make sure that we're okay, and we have to make sure that everybody else is okay. And we have to lead by example by making sure we are giving the downtime. Don't be present 24/7. You know, make sure that you're having the downtime, and people will look at you saying, well, he or she is taking time out and spending some time with the family or building some Lego. That's what I did, or training or whatever. You've got to get that balance. You've got to force that balance. And people will then look and see you're doing that, and they will do the same thing. There's nothing worse than, you know, watching somebody, you know, working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and then everybody who follows them trying to do the same thing. That is a recipe for absolute disaster. So we have to lead by example, and you know, just make sure that people are getting that balance right. And yeah, everybody needs a hobby. Lego's a great it just takes your mind away from what you're doing. You know, it doesn't have to be, well, just go for a walk. You know, you just get yourself away from the damn screens.
Yeah.
And just be in the moment, and just forget about everything, and get your head straight. I can't stress enough how important it is to get the balance right.
And I just maybe one last statement I want to say is that we just talked about that it's important to have compassion and empathy towards others. But I think it's also important to have compassion and empathy towards yourself. They are not mutually exclusive. So starting there is a good point.
Yeah, I think certainly it's been fascinating to hear you both talk about the role, because I think CISOs are very interesting people, just generally, just the why they take on that role and why they, you know, they do care. And you see, I think that empathy is a big part of their toolkit. But as well, I think they are in a very difficult position. And I think that the key point that has emerged, it's not all on them. And I think, you know, their organization, and they can be part of that change, has to accept what they're there for and not thrust the whole responsibility for running the business on them, but work together. And maybe because that's the whole point of the business, they're all trying to do it together.
I'll just put just one more thing on that. What's been interesting and a bit of a concern actually is I've been working from home, everybody else has been working from home, my kids have been listening and watching and observing me whilst I've been trying to lead security strategies, etc. from home. My two children would now rather walk over hot coals than have a career in security, because they say it's absolutely relentless, Dad. You go in there at 7 o'clock, you surface at 11, you eat something that was, you know, that should really be in the dog, you go to sleep and it starts again. They don't want that life. What a terrible advertisement for our industry. We need to think about that, because I don't think the next generation of security leaders want to be anything like the security leaders of today. And it's just a terrible example of how, you know, what we've become. Okay, I know that it's unusual times, but even pre-pandemic, and I'm sure Monica will agree with me, the hours that we were working were creeping up. And
oh,
up
absolutely.
And up, you know, we were spending doing, you know, life stuff was becoming less and less and less. All that we've done is amplified an existing problem, and something has to change.
Okay, thank you both. That's been, I'd say, absolutely fascinating. Really good to get your experience of just living through this and coping with it, and you know, and as well hearing how it's changing. Thanks everybody for listening. You can find more podcasts on the ISF podcast channel or at securityforum.org, where you can also learn more about ISF research tools and guidance. We'll also put some links in there for Monica's podcast. Thank you everybody, and we'll hopefully you'll tune in again soon.